This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome back to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be on adoption. I'm joined by Barrister Emma Harmon from Three Paper Buildings Chambers in London. Emma is an experienced and fearless advocate with a meticulous attention to detail, both in and out of court. She represents at all levels of the family courts, including the High Court and Court of Appeal. Emma's clients range from local authorities, parents, grandparents and guardians in a variety of cases, many involving complex and technical legal issues. Emma is recognised as a leading individual in her field and she is listed in Chambers and Partners and in the Legal 500. Emma, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me and your very generous description of my achievement.
No, it's totally deserved, totally. So, adoption. Adoption is a topic close to my heart and a process that we have gone through in my household. It wasn't until I had the experience firsthand that I actually realised the many myths that I thought to be true about adoption and what was meant in the eyes of the law of my existing family setup and legal structure, so to speak. According to figures published by the Department of Education, the number of children adopted in the UK in 2020 was down 18% at 2,870 on 2019. And this was said to be the case because of the impact on court proceedings as a result of the pandemic. This episode will give you tons of important points that you need to know if you have what we call these days a blended family, where you and your partner have children from previous relationships. You may be or are considering adoption, and you need to understand this subject bottom up without the legal jargon. Emma, can we start by explaining what is meant by parental responsibility of a child and when a parent would automatically have or not have parental responsibility? And I ask our listeners to bear with us because although these two words sound like legally words, as I like to put it, you will very quickly see why it is important to have a basic understanding of what parental responsibility, also referred to as PR, means.
Firstly, the definition of responsibility, it is pretty much what it says. It's the responsibilities of being a parent. There is a definition that is provided in the Children Act, it's section 3, subsection 1, for anybody that would want to look it up. But what it says is it's all the rights, the duties, the powers and the responsibilities and authority that by law a parent of a child has in relation to the child and their property. So that's a very broad definition.
Yes.
But generally speaking, what parental responsibility encompasses is simply the duty to look after and bring up a child in accordance with his or her best interests. So there's no list set out within the Children Act, but generally what's commonly accepted are things such as providing a child with a home, protecting and maintaining the child, contact with a child, education, that's a very common one, choosing which school a child should or shouldn't go to, religion, consenting to medical treatment,
yes,
removal out of the country, and also consenting to adoption. So they're just some, that's not a definitive list, that's just some of the common areas where parental responsibility can become an issue. What I'll say, and it's important to note, is that parental responsibility is something that's joint and it's equal. Neither parent that has it has a predominant right over the other parent. And if there is any issue, then that's where the court comes in. The court,
yes,
makes that decision if the parents can't decide.
I was just going to say that that's one of the biggest areas of myth, that mother automatically has more rights over a father as a standing point and starting point. That's not the case. That's not the case when mother has more parental responsibility than a father or less, so to say.
you're absolutely right. There's a
big fat myth, Emma. It's really big.
It is. But it's not just mothers. It's parents who are what they see as the primary carer. So whether it's a mother or a father, if they are looking after the child the majority of the time, they will often think that they effectively have a trump card and that they can make those decisions. But they can't. Parental responsibility is joint and equal. And if you cannot decide about these things, such as school is a very common one that comes up, then you have to make an application to the court, and it's then the court that will make the decision for you.
Yes.
You asked also about automatic acquisition, so how parents automatically get parental responsibility. The position at birth is that the mother of a child automatically, quite rightly so, acquires parental responsibility. But it is slightly different for fathers. It's only automatic if either that father was married to the mother at the time of the child's birth, or if they're not married, that father is registered on the birth certificate as the father of the child.
So let me ask you this, Emma, because I need to clear this up for myself. Now, I get the bit about the birth certificate. If a father's name is on the birth certificate, he automatically has parental responsibility. So say if they're married, but the father is not on the birth certificate, does it mean definitively that because the couple were married at the time of the conception, it's when the mother became pregnant, isn't it? Not necessarily the birth, that he will automatically have parental responsibility even if he's not on the birth certificate?
It's marriage at the time that it's registered. So if two parents marry and they register and they're married at the time of the registration, they have, the father automatically has parental responsibility.
And so registration of the birth?
Yes.
Yes.
They don't need to be, the father doesn't need to be registered on the birth certificate. What matters is the marriage.
Right.
But generally, if two parents are married, then what usually follows is inevitably that the father will, that or the mother will, and the mother and father will register that father as the father on the birth certificate.
Right, got it.
Where we do start to see problems though for fathers is where they're not married and they're not registered on the birth certificate. They don't have parental responsibility, PR. And that then becomes a problem sometimes. Only mother has parental responsibility.
Got it.
So the only way after that father could get parental responsibility, there's a number of ways. Parental responsibility agreement with the mother, parental responsibility order, or going to court for what's called a child arrangements order, a live with order, or a parental responsibility order. And there's a special guardianship order or an adoption order. But I won't bore you with the details of each of those.
They're not boring, but they're good. They would make a good next podcast, let's put it that way, because they're all very interesting. And this is why I said to our listeners at the beginning of this podcast, just bear with us, because parental responsibility is very important when you're talking about who has the say over the child. And Emma very usefully said, look, it's the say over the child's well-being, education, medication, where the child lives, even things like registry or changing the child's name, all these sorts of things. So if a couple get married and they have children from a previous relationship, do they automatically become the legal parents, both become the legal parents of the children that they bring into that marriage with PR because they got married?
So if we're talking about the new family,
yes,
where we have step parents, the short answer is no, they don't. They don't. They
yes, don't. And this is where I was done like a kipper, because I thought, oh, we automatically become one big legal unit.
No, I'm afraid not. It's not as straightforward as that. And for most families, so for most separated families, but also for blended families, in my view, that's probably the right way that the law should be. I know that your case is a slight exception, but actually for policy reasons, I think that probably is the right way. And the reason that I say that is that even when a family becomes a separated family and it then evolves into a blended family, just because those biological parents are separated, it doesn't mean that the involvement in that child's life or the responsibility should be any less or interfered with in any way, particularly if that what we call the absent parent. Let's look at the most commonplace scenario. Children live mainly with mum, dad has contact on occasions. When you have that sort of scenario, it wouldn't be right and it wouldn't be fair if the new stepfather had legal rights and had parental responsibility.
More than the biological. No, I get it. In those circumstances where both parents are active in a child's life, because you might end your relationship, but you don't end parenthood, or you shouldn't end parenthood because your relationship has ended, I guess it, when you look at it like that, you think, yeah, absolutely, that makes sense. Why should a biological parent lose legal right over their child because the other parent of their child decided to go and get married? I get it. But then when I guess I sort of had tunnel vision over it, and I thought, well, hold on. This is why I thought it was really important to explain parental responsibility, because where I was sort of coming from was the new family, the new marriage and the children when that should become a legal unit. But legal unit means you've got PR, you've got that parental responsibility over both parents, both husband and wife, or both parents have that parental responsibility in that relationship. When one doesn't, that legal unit is not a legal unit. Right?
That's right. But there are two distinctions between a legal parent and having parental responsibility. Just because you're a legal parent, it doesn't always automatically follow that you would have parental responsibility. Again, probably another topic for another podcast.
Of course, this is the law, Emma. There's always going to be strands, you know, it's never going to end.
But one prime example would be in the world of surrogacy, for example, that you might well be a legal parent, but you don't automatically have parental responsibility. It's a very complex area of law, and it would be another topic.
I think it'd be another three podcasts at least, just to explain the title, surrogacy, and what does it mean legally? Yeah, no, I get it. But for these purposes, you see, I, like Joe Bloggs, and I consider myself as Joe Bloggs when it comes to thinking about many areas of the law, thought legal unit and parental, I didn't even know what parental responsibility meant when I was thinking about legal unit, you know, many years ago, and thinking, oh, what does my family look like now that I'm married and I've got a blended family, as they call it. But when you take it apart, I guess the what we're saying is that you don't automatically get parental responsibility or legally become a family just because you get married. The children absolutely there don't automatically, you know.
Absolutely. And if you have the scenario, I think there's two scenarios. You've got the blended family where there is still a relationship between the child and what I describe as the absent parent. And you have the other scenario where there is no relationship with that absent parent. If we look at the first scenario where there is still that ongoing relationship, if the new family and the new step parent was to acquire parental responsibility, actually you would probably heighten the levels of conflict. And often in separated families, conflict is a problem. And that's what I see sadly in the court process. The reason I say you'd have more conflict is because, as I said before, parental responsibility is joint and equal. Everybody who has parental responsibility has to agree. You would then end up with the scenario that you have the new family unit in a 2-1 scenario.
Yes.
So actually, let's say absent dad, his rights probably in some circumstances would actually be reduced because you'd have mum and new dad making decisions that they both agree with.
Well, it just wouldn't work, would it? Because a new couple are clearly going to be in agreement, as opposed to it's highly unlikely that they're not going to agree with the absent parent if things get heated and sticky and all this sort of stuff. So I totally get it. And also, I'm assuming, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, because I certainly don't, that you can't have more than two parents having parental responsibility. Or would it be a guardian outside of that, perhaps?
People can acquire parental responsibility even if you're not a biological parent. So an aunt, an uncle,
More than two, more than two people?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
I didn't know that. Yes. God, it can get messy then, couldn't it? If you've got sort of three or four people.
Absolutely, it really can. Hence, That's why it's not straightforward, and it's not easy to acquire parental responsibility, because sometimes it can actually cause more problems
than solve. No, I get it. So let's just get this straight. Couple get married, bring children from previous relationships into that marriage. They then have a child. The new couple have a child. Does that new child become the full siblings of the other children from that couple, from its mum and dad's other relationships? Or are they only ever half siblings, unless it's changed, obviously, in the courtroom?
They are only ever half siblings.
It's another myth, you see? That's a thing. People think that if you share the same, lots of people think, same mum, particularly the same mother, you think, well, that's my whole full brother or sister. But if you don't share the same parents, you're only ever going to be half, even if you do share the same mother or father. Interesting.
That's right. The only exception to that is if an adoption order is made, a step-parent adoption order is made. Then that means that step-parent becomes the legal parent, has parental responsibility, extinguishes the parental responsibility and also the status of legal parent of the biological, let's say, father. And then all of the siblings, the half-siblings, are full legal siblings. That's the only exception.
And that's another thing I think that's not known, because once you establish the whole half-brother, half-sister position, I don't think many people know, and again, this is something that I certainly didn't know, that they become full brothers or sisters if an adoption process or parental responsibility process, it's really the adoption process that makes them the full siblings, because those parents then become the legal parents, so to speak, to the whole bunch of you. And I think people don't really know that could happen. They think, well, if they're only half brothers and sisters, they're only ever going to be half brothers and sisters legally. We get the whole sort of blood and biological side of stuff, but I'm talking as a legal unit. So let's take this scenario, right, where an absent parent, so the other parent, hasn't been in the child's life for, say, a long period, over 5 years. You've moved into another relationship and you're thinking about, look, you know, I want my child to have a parent that's, they can say, this is my legal parent. What are the initial steps for applying for adoption for your new partner to legally become the parent of your child?
I know that you mentioned, say, for example, a period of over 5 years, and I know that you're not suggesting that is a key point. So I just want to make clear, there isn't any particular period of time of absence of a parent from a child's life that would make it either a stronger or a weaker application for an adoption order. But let's say, for example, if it's a young baby, say sort of 12 to 18 months, you may well be still able to get an adoption order, because that parent has shown absolutely no interest or has been quite explicit in not wishing to have any involvement in that child's life. What I'd also say, and I will answer your question in a moment, what I'll also say is about, you need to think, is adoption right? Because it does permanently sever the relationship with the other parent. And there are other alternatives if you simply seek to have parental responsibility. But the advantage of adoption for many families is that sense of stability that it provides within a family. So my first suggestion, the first step would be, is to seek legal advice, because the end aim is to achieve an adoption order, which is made by the court, and it can only be made by the court, and that requires an application to the court. And there are a lot of steps that need to be undertaken in the first place, and criteria that needs to be satisfied before you even think about making that application. So get it right. It's that old adage of fail to prepare to fail.
Yes.
And just some of the criteria, in order for you to be able to make an application, a step-parent application, you have to be 21 or over. You have to live in a part of the British Isles. The child has to be below the age of 18. We can't do adult adoption, child adoptions. You can in some countries, but not in our country. And the child has to have lived with the applicant, so the step-parent, for 6 continuous months prior to the application. The other really important point, and I think this is one of the key points, is that you have to give notice to your local authority that you're intending to apply for an adoption order. And that notice has to be given at least 3 months and no more than 2 years prior to you making that application for an adoption order. They then have to do, or they then have to investigate and carry out what's called a suitability report.
The council, which is, yes.
Yes. They have to, and just to make clear, the council, the local authority, is the authority where the applicants have their home. That's
yes.
the one. That
yes, your local council, your local borough council, yes.
Absolutely. And the report is what it says it is. It's looking at the suitability of the applicant to adopt a child. So those are the first steps. The social worker will then come and meet with the family. They'll carry out their assessment. How many meetings they have depends on each case, and that comes down to resources, it comes down to some of the issues that either exist at the start of that investigation or during the process of that investigation. Some might be more complex and the social worker needs to be involved more. But it's not something to fear, and that's what I want to make clear to people. I think some people think, gosh, I'm going to have a social worker come in and turn my life upside down and question every aspect of my life.
Yes, yes. Well, I get it, Emma. I hear you. And let me say, it's not something to fear. I've been through it myself, so I can say that. But it is intrusive. So yes. Be prepared. I mean, I said to the social worker that came into my house for the adoption that we went through, you know, she said, do you have any sort of recommendations of how you think this whole thing went? And I said, the only thing I'd say, because she was lovely, you know, we ended up getting on really well at the end, because when she first turned up and she was asking questions, I thought, why should I tell you that? What's that got to do with anything? I said to her, the only thing I'd say is let people know that it is an intrusive process. But, you know, if you just say that, then they can deal with, I guess, with what's to come, rather than you just think, oh, well, this is just going to be a little like a little meeting and we'll just tell them what time we eat and what time we go to bed and what goes on generally, you know. And that way you're not shocked by the intrusion, or you don't feel, you're not questioning yourself over this is very intrusive. But it's definitely, I totally agree, it's not anything to fear, and that person has got the best interests of the child, your child essentially, or the child you're trying to adopt at heart, which, you know, has to be a good starting point for everyone.
Absolutely. And I think, yes, it is an intrusive process, but in order for you to be able to digest that and accept that process, you need to understand, quite rightly, as you've said, that there's a reason why it is quite an intrusive process, because the order that you're asking for is, in the eyes of the court of the UK, a draconian and intrusive order. It permanently severs legal relationships, and therefore the court wants to know that the person asking to become that child's legal parent is absolutely suitable and has been fully investigated.
Yes.
So the process itself, just to give an idea as to the level of intrusion, the sort of things that they'll be exploring, that there is a list set out, and I won't bore you with that, but it's in the Adoption and Children Act, Annex A, and it's looking at information about the child, information about the parents, their heritage, the relationship between the child, the biological parents, and the prospective adopter, any orders that have been made. They will, depending on the age of the child, meet with the child to ascertain his or her wishes and feelings.
On more than one occasion. On more yeah. than one occasion, because, you know, and yes. they want to see the child again, if it's age appropriate, of course. You can't obviously sit with a 2-year-old on your own and start questioning, you know, different times of sort of the process, different times of the process, to try and really get a cross reference of what the child is thinking, feeling, away from the parents and on their own. So they don't obviously feel like they can't say what they need to say and how they need to say it.
Absolutely, because it's their ascertainable wishes and feelings, understanding their true feelings, that they're their own independent wishes and feelings, and they understand the nature of the order and the consequences of that order. So the older a child, the more meetings that there will be, the more weight that will be attached to their wishes and feelings. They have a greater maturity and capacity to be able to understand what's being asked of them. The other things that they will also look at are the health of the prospective adopter, educational history, employment history, occupation, income, household, and criminal history. It isn't, I think there's a misconception that it's a bit of a tick box exercise. And if X hasn't, box hasn't been ticked, they haven't got
they're not appropriate to be a parent.
Then they're not, yes, but that's not right. Everything is looked at in a global way. It's a global overview in terms of the suitability to adopt. The exception to that, where the rule, legislation sets out very clearly that a parent would not be, or a step-parent would not be suitable to adopt, is if the police check show that they're convicted of a certain offence at the age of 18 or over. And that would be something along the lines of offence against a child, a sexual offence of any person, or any customs offences. Those are some of the examples. Those are the exception that if that box is ticked or crossed, you're out, you're not suitable.
I get it. I totally get it. Emma, we've got time to discuss two more areas which I really, really want to go through. So let's talk about this. Does a biological parent have to give consent for the child to be adopted by a step-parent? And what if they don't agree? What if they say, no, sorry, I'm not happy for somebody else to adopt my child? Where does that leave the parties then?
Short answer is yes, they do have to consent. If they don't consent, then the court can dispense with their consent if the welfare of the child requires that consent to be dispensed with.
Excellent. So let me just clarify that and break it down a bit more, as I like to do. So what we're saying is the biological parent has to consent. However, a court can say we're going to override that if you don't consent for a step-parent to adopt because we believe it's in the best interest of the child to do so. And therefore, we're going to order that the step-parent can adopt. That's what we're saying.
Yes, yes. The court has to make that assessment, though, that it is in the best interest of the child, that it will further their welfare. And the court will look at a number of things in the Adoption and Children Act 2002, wishes and feelings of the children, the likely effect throughout their life, not just their minority, but their life of any order, any harm they've suffered, the relationship that they've got with any relatives, the wishes and feelings of that child regarding any relatives, because obviously it severs that relationship. The court will then also look at, when deciding whether to dispense with that parent's consent, and they're more likely to do it if the non-consenting parent hasn't had care of the child or tried or asserted their parental responsibility. Also, if the non-consenting parent has only had either very infrequent or no contact with the child. And also if there's a really well-established family unit in the home of the parent and the step-parent in which de facto family ties have existed for a significant period of time. Those are the circumstances in which the court's likely to say, yes, it's in the best interest of the child for that consent to be dispensed with.
Absolutely. So, default position, the court is interested in what's best for the child. So if you've got two disagreeing parents for their own personal reasons, honestly, and I've seen it in court, and I'm sure you have far more than I have, the court literally will just look right through that and say what is in the best interest of this child for the child now and for the future.
Absolutely. The court will listen to what the parents say and what the parents want, but ultimately the focus is on the welfare of the child. If you have a case where the father or the absent parent has a relationship with the child, does have contact with the child, your application for an adoption order is unlikely to be successful.
Yes.
But there are other alternatives in those circumstances to get parental responsibility or just to have greater rights.
Yes, yes. No, I get it. I hear you. So when an adoption takes place, and I do feel it's really important that we try and get this into this podcast, the legal implications for a child once they've been adopted, so that the biological parent has no right over that child legally, if you like, to make decisions for the child. What are the legal implications for the child? I just want to really briefly talk about that because they can be quite serious, and I don't think it's just common knowledge that legal ties, inheritance ties, all of this stuff stops when you're no longer the legal parent. However, the adopting parent then takes that on board and the child has a benefit with that. But let's talk about that very quickly, if we can, please, Emma.
Yeah, so as I think I said earlier in the podcast, when an adoption order is made, it permanently severs the legal relationship between the biological parents, let's say the biological father and the child. The child is then treated in law as if they had been born as the child of the adopter, of the step parent. So it extinguishes the parental responsibility of the biological parent. Any half siblings, as we were discussing earlier, become full siblings. And as I say, upon the making of an adoption order, the child will be treated in law as being the child of the step parent adopter and the parent. So, for example, the biological mother and the step father, who's now the adoptive father, legal father. When you look at what rights that child has, for example, you've mentioned inheritance. As I said, a child who's been adopted is treated legally and is an eligible claimant against the parent's estate. So can claim against their mother's, can claim against their adoptive father's estate. But an adopted child can't claim against the estate of their deceased biological parent, because even if they are adopted after the death of their biological parent, they can't claim, because an adopted child is treated in law as if he were not the child of any person other than the adopters or adopter. So really yes. significant.
It is. It's big stuff.
It is. It is. And it's these sorts of things that people won't necessarily be aware of or think about. And the same as things such as child maintenance.
Yes.
All of those things cease. So what I think I said earlier as well was it's really important to get that legal advice at the beginning. You don't have to have the legal advice throughout, but get that legal advice at the beginning so you know what the advantages are of an adoption order for your family.
Absolutely.
What the disadvantages may well be, and also what the process is, because it isn't right for everybody, but at the same time it can be an absolutely wonderful order to be made that provides that family and that child with that stability and that sense of belonging that they are in certain circumstances rightly entitled to.
No, absolutely. And that is just golden, because I yourself, I am in the legal business, as it were, day in, day out myself, but I still sought legal advice that was specialist to this area when me and my family went through the process of adoption. And it is golden, because every situation is going to be unique, very unique to what's going on with that household, with that child's life, with both parents' lives. And I have to say, I know you do direct access, Emma, and I want to tell people about that. So what that means, everybody, is that you can go directly to Emma to instruct her to help you with her work through her clerk. So you'd call her chambers at Three Paper Buildings and you'd say, I'd like Emma to help me assist us with this matter. Not every case is built for direct access. However, if it can be taken on directly by a barrister, in this case directly by Emma, you do save on legal costs, because you're effectively cutting out the middleman, the solicitor's firm, in between. But Emma, that's all we've got time for.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you ever so much for being a guest on my podcast today. And what I'll say to our listeners is, don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts. And you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn and YouTube by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you for listening.